This is Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Erica D. Smith, filling in for Steve Chiotakis. Watson's in mourning after two were killed and nine were hurt in shootings last month near the Jordan Downs and Imperial Courts housing projects. Unfortunately, gang violence isn't a new problem for this community.
We've been doing wrong for so long, it's time to do right. And just give us a chance, that's all. We just want a chance.
They are coming together, bonding together, so that we can live peacefully in this community together.
There's talk of a truce in a war some thought might never end.
And the Bloods is Crip, that's one. We want to have peace in the black community, not only in gangs, but the whole community.
So you come together and what do? I mean, what's it about? What's the goal? What's the mission?
Empowering our community. That's what it's all about.
That was from 1992, during the gang truce famously signed in this South LA community, and right before the uprising over Rodney King. Watts is, of course, known for its uprising and political organizing in the 1960s. So this recent uptick in violence, at a time when homicides are on the decline citywide, has been frustrating and disappointing. In response, a coalition of officials from the LAPD, the city, and the community have asked residents to avoid large gatherings for the rest of the year. But they're also working on long-term solutions. Joining us to discuss the situation is Fernando Rejon, director of the Urban Peace Institute, and his colleague, Andre Christian, who heads up the nonprofit's work in Watts. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, how you doing?
So, Fernando, let's start with you. You and members of the Watts Gang Task Force recently met with Mayor Karen Bass and members of the LAPD. What did you discuss?
Well, it was a community conversation regarding what the needs are currently to address levels of violence. The mayor was very supportive and really asked, look, I'm behind community intervention work. What do y'all need? You need to tell me how to scale up a lot of these community-based safety services that have demonstrated so much success and promise. And part of that conversation was listening to community members and the community saying what they need. And what they said is, we need more intervention workers out here. We need the right intervention workers, people who have strong LTOs or license to operate, meaning high level of credibility in the community, in order to reach the ones highest risk of violence. And so it was a good conversation. I think it was very supportive. And last I followed up with the mayor's office, they said that they have some dollars to get some more community intervention workers out there in Watts.
Yeah. How exactly are the government, law enforcement, and nonprofits like yours working together on this problem?
I mean, a lot of it is communication, understanding what the needs are, training intervention workers. It's one thing to put intervention workers in the streets. It's another thing to make sure that they're professionally trained and certified through the training academy. But also really some strategic thinking and coordination amongst communities, nonprofits, as well as government and law enforcement leaders. Every sector has a role in ensuring safety and peace. And as we know that, communities in South LA and in other areas most impacted by violence don't experience the same or enjoy the same level of safety that more affluent communities do. So when you're working in communities that are more impacted by violence, the safety is different, and it's a different strategy that is going to require more investment, more resources, and more coordination to ensure their level of safety is achieved.
Mm-hmm. Andre, while LA as a whole, we've seen a drop in violent crime, Watts has been the exception. Why do you think that is?
Communication, like Fernando said, because, as we first started this work, it wasn't a lot of communication going on. Everybody pretty much had the idea on what needed to be done in order to stop violence. Once we start kind of having those conversations, LAPD had a lane, the mayor's office had a lane, and community had a lane. So as that communication started going and everybody staying in their lane without crossing lanes, it was a better understanding. If we need to come and tweak something or something of that nature. And just what all we always had a problem with as being community violence interventionists is you can't quantify what didn't happen. So if you hear about something happening, you like, okay, it goes all out, media and things like that, but you didn't hear about what didn't happen. And as for Watts, like this last thing where a couple of things happened, you haven't heard about any back and forth going on. That's the work of the community workers, having those conversations, getting deep into those conversations, but it's not nothing that we can just put out there in a newspaper. This is what was done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, talk a little bit more about that. You've been training gang intervention workers. What does it take to keep people from actively gangbanging and to preserve the peace?
one of the tools that I use, everybody had their own tools that they use. One of the things that worked for me, and I always let people know, you reap what you sow. And when you start planting that seed and you reap what you sow, do you really love your baby like that? Do you really love your grandmother like that? Do you really love your mother like that? Because when you go out and respond and do certain things in a certain community and you tag to that right there and it come back, it doesn't always get the person they're looking for. That could be your mother. It could be your auntie. So you have to ask yourself, do you really care about them like that? So that helped people start trying to put out fires, as well as the ones that say, well, my baby's not involved, or we're not a part of that life, so we don't need to help. But that don't mean that you can't, it can't happen to you. So if you start addressing and dealing with violence to the best of your ability, you don't have to worry about accidental shootings, violence even picking up, because you're trying to stop violence as a whole. And if you can't do the same thing, you do something. And that's my word, you know, just as I talk to different people, because people don't look at it like that, because, you know, you always hear that thing we've been hearing for years, my baby ain't never hurt nobody, and things like that. But you don't know what your son doing, your daughter doing, and it could be an innocent person, but it was somebody you could have talked to that was trying to commit violence. Because a lot of times people realize what their kids doing and certain stuff going on with them, and they don't talk to them about it. But then when it comes back, now you want to talk about it, but you saw what your daughter was doing or what your son was doing. So that was the kind of conversation I have, and I don't point the finger. I just throw it out there, generally talking, and it's a shoe fit wear it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Fernando, I mean, so you said when it comes to some of these recent shootings that they were driven in part, at least by social media posts that have been, you know, kind of pouring gasoline on local feuds. How is the work you do? And I know you're really busy with what you're doing now, but how does that, the work you do in intervention, change in the social media age?
Well, I think intervention workers, we also need to get younger. We have a lot of great veteran intervention workers that have put in a lot of work keeping peace on the streets. And, you know, they should continue to, you know, to train and continue to do the intervention work and recruit younger intervention workers. I think social media is just another, a new dynamic and a new frontier that impacts how violence manifests on the streets. If we don't pay attention to social media, we're not tuned into the realities of the youth. But then also we have to understand is that how violence manifests now is different than how it did before. Regarding before, people could spray paint on walls and people could cover it up, and it's not necessarily, maybe not everybody saw it. On social media, you can post something, something disrespectful, dissing another community, and it can go out and thousands of people could see it at one time. And a lot of times it's never taken down. So it's there in perpetuity, which could continue to inflame tensions if someone didn't see it immediately. And so, you know, that frontier is really important. And we're looking at building out new infrastructures around how to monitor social media from a peace lens, how to do some intervention on social media to where you have intervention workers who can monitor social media and kind of stay on top of some feuds that are coming up or things that are ongoing, any type of back and forth, to interrupt it before it manifests into reality. And that's new. And that's a new thing for intervention. I know we have some colleagues in Chicago that share with us that 80% of the violence is fueled by social media in Chicago. That's what they found. I'm not sure what the number is in LA, but I'm sure if it's not 80%, it's probably rising, because this next generation is really putting a lot out there on social media. And, you know, it can create a lot of issues, misinformation, rumors that can really spark violence in the real world.
You know, speaking of history, Watts is, you know, famous, as I mentioned, for its political organizing and the uprising in the 60s. Does that history at all affect what's going on in the community today?
It really does make a difference. And I don't know why. And it's not just because I'm from the Watts area, because for some reason, people always go back to 65, the time of the riot and stuff. But it seems like most of the time that I see in my life, when Watts come together, a lot of other people come together. I mean, this is from state to state. I don't know why it's like that. And that comes up from 65, that comes up to 92, to right now where we are here today. And I don't know why it happens like that. So that's even more of a harder push to get everything right, because I feel like if Watts get together, and maybe it's because all the different developments right there in the same little area, and a lot of people feel like if Watts can do it, anybody can do it.
Yeah, Andre, I mean, do you think that the truce that was brokered in the 90s provides some kind of blueprint for what's going on today?
Yeah, because a lot of times when you hear about that blueprint, a lot of people talk about the maintenance, even though it's people that are still dealing with each other from that 92 peace treaty, but it didn't get maintained. It was just more like a big party. It wasn't organized and it wasn't a structure put behind it. And those conversations go on right now today. So as it's starting to come together more and more, you have more people talking about organizing and having a plan. You know, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So that's where the ones that was a part of that feel like they dropped the ball at. They didn't organize it once they had all the right minds at the table. It was just like a big old party.
Fernando, your work at the Urban Peace Institute focuses a lot on community safety and well-being. You know, what does it take for a community like Watts to fully thrive, and what more can city officials do?
Well, I think, you know, Watts has really been an epicenter of political organizing for the African-American community. I mean, it's important to note the Latino community really grew in the Watts area as well. So you have, you know, Latino and African-American dynamics that exist there. But the history of the gangs and how they evolved, you know, in the beginning it was black and brown. So that kind of rich history of understanding the cultural dynamics, I think, is an important aspect of it. The political organizing, I think, brings a lot of attention to Watts, and rightfully so. And I think the community power to really hold public sector, government officials, and others accountable to what the needs are is really helped Watts really push forward. I think the 92 truce was very pivotal for Watts, but also the rest of the country, as people saw Bloods and Crips coming together. But also, it's important to understand, like in the Harbor area and in the Valley, there was also truces amongst the Latino gangs as well. And so when people talk about origin stories of truces, for the African Americans, you know, a lot of people will look to Watts, but we also have to look to other communities as well that have been holding down the peace movement for a long time and put that together as part of the LA story. But particularly with Watts, Watts is organized. I think Watts needs consistent investment, but a coordinated strategy that really invests resources in areas where there's the highest need. So for example, in additional CIWs, community intervention workers, but ensuring that they're coordinated and that they have the right level of LTO to reach the younger generation that might be involved in some of the social media and some of the aspects of violence. You know, there are other issues going on in Watts that people like Andre are helping to address, but an organized community that can hold city officials accountable and law enforcement accountable to what the needs are is really what makes Watts such an important place in the city of LA.
Andre, we've talked a lot about the problems in Watts, but there's also a lot of good going on there. What gives you hope for the future?
In speaking with a lot of people, because the mentality has changed, because I can remember when I really first really started doing this work and having a lot of conversation, you had a lot of people that were just set on not changing, holding on to old grudges and things like that. So that would, then you had organizational separation, you know, people that had old animosity from years ago and passing it on to the kids and the people that's doing the work. So we had to start from there. So we started dealing with a lot of the older people in the community and having those conversations and sitting them at the table. You know, you say you're here for our babies, but y'all got to put y'all differences down too and come to the table as well. I just had something like that happen not too long ago, and they started listening. And then they invited me to, you know, one of the boards that they got in Watts just because of that, because a lot of times people don't speak on the elephant in the room, because it's just like if your mother and your father into it, and then the father trying to pull you one way, the mother trying to pull you another way. And that goes on in community. And if you're really about peace, you have to agree to disagree sometime. It's about organizing, coming together, and really trying to promote peace, because when you promote separation, it's just really not no good for the world. So if we all trying to go in the same direction.
Fernando Rejon is executive director of the Urban Peace Institute, and Andre Christian is a violence intervention specialist in Watts. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, police are supposed to keep people safe, but for one North Hollywood business owner, officers did the exact opposite, and now he's suing. That's just after this on Greater LA. You just heard about how Watts is dealing with the surge in gang violence and how the community is working with the LAPD to stop the bloodshed. While cops are, in theory, supposed to help keep Angelino safe, sometimes their actions can wind up creating even more problems. Like last summer when U.S. Marshals and an LAPD SWAT team destroyed a printing shop in North Hollywood while chasing a suspect. It's been more than a year since the raid, and Carlos Pena says his printing business is still in shambles. Now he's filed a federal lawsuit to seek compensation for the damages. He joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Carlos.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So to start with, take us back to the time when the raid happened. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I was doing my work in my computer, and then we heard a commotion going on in the back at the parking lot. So I tried to step outside. I opened up the back door, the rear door, and I see all these U.S. Marshals pointing their guns towards me, and I couldn't understand. I didn't know what was going on. Suddenly, in a matter of not even seconds, I see this guy coming rushing at me, and then he hits me, and then he got inside the shop and closed the door behind him and barricaded himself inside.
And so what happened once the police went in? The LAPD SWAT team showed up after that?
When he barricaded himself inside the shop, the U.S. Marshals didn't attempt to go in, but then they called in the SWAT team, the LA SWAT team. And then a couple hours later, they went inside, and that's where everything got destroyed. They were kicking doors, even the toilet. I mean, it's terrible. It's like a whole scene.
So after the raid happened, and what were your interactions like with the police? Did they offer to help with any of the damage that they had caused?
See, it started at 1:30 in the afternoon. They kept me there until 1:30 in the morning of the following day, right? And they took me in. It was terrible. Like, you couldn't even survive there 5 seconds without a mask. So they put a mask on me and I saw everything. It's terrible. But what they did is that when I came back outside in the parking lot, one of the officers, the U.S. Marshals officers, he gave me a sheet, a claim sheet, so I could file a claim against the U.S. Marshals, but I was denied the first time. And then I resubmitted the claim. And then a couple months later, they denied me, alleging that the U.S. Marshals are immune to anything that can happen for any kind of damage.
Wow. That sounds very complicated on your end. And it's been more than a year since this has happened. What have been the long-term impacts on your business? You talked about the destruction, but, you know, what has been the effects on your ability to actually make money?
Okay, look, I lost about 82% of my clientele. I've had my business for 31 or 32 years, and I lost practically everything, all my equipment, all my income. And then in the end, someone did an interview on me, and people called me from other print shops offering me their help. And one of them sold me a machine that was about $7,500. He sold it to me for $2,000. And that's how I restarted everything in my garage. It's just affected me economically. I don't know if mentally, you know, because when I saw the shambles, all my shop, I just told myself, why didn't this guy just shoot me? Why didn't he shoot me? Because I had lost everything in a matter of hours.
Did insurance cover anything?
For this type of damage that has to do with the government, especially chasing a suspect, they said that I was supposed to have a type of insurance called, a type of policy called terrorism, which is, you can buy it separately, but, you know, it almost cost $1,000. And, you know, a small shop, I mean, and did we know about that? I never knew. I never thought that this could happen to me. And this is terrible. Every door had been closing on me.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you have filed a federal lawsuit seeking compensation. Why did you feel the need to take that step?
It's simply because I had lost everything for something that I didn't do. It's not my fault. I mean, I didn't call in the guy to come inside my shop. That's the last thing you could even think about. And especially the fact that you trust the authorities. And for something like this, you know, it's terrible that I have been paying the consequences of letting a guy loose that's a criminal. He had about 25 felonies. First, they said it was 9. And then they said that it was a lot more than that. They mentioned 25 things that he was wanted for. And I don't think it's fair, no matter who I am. I don't think it's fair that I lose everything for nothing, because they didn't even catch him.
So I'm curious, what was your opinion of law enforcement in general before all of this happened? And how has it changed now?
Look, a lot of guys in my family have been in the service. I didn't get to go. And you are proud of your authorities. You are proud of the way, you know, things appear to be. But in the end, it's been really, really disappointing.
Carlos Pena is owner of NoHo Printing and Graphics and is currently suing the LAPD for damages for destroying his small printing business during a raid. We reached out to the LAPD and they declined to comment on the lawsuit. Thanks so much for joining us, Carlos.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. You can check out the show anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA or on KCRW's iPhone or Android app. You can also get the podcast version of the show anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search KCRW Greater LA. While you're there, drop us a line and tell us what's happening in your neighborhood. What story would you like to hear? Next week, we'll hear from musician and author Kristen Hirsch of Throwing Muses and Belly Fame about her new solo album, Clear Pond. And we'll take a look at an upcoming vote to require officials in the Orange Unified School District to notify parents if their children come out as LGBTQ in school. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Celine Mendiola, Zeke Reed, Phil Richards, Sonia Geist, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Comito, Amy Ta, and Mike Vogel all helped assemble today's episode. I'm Erica D. Smith. It's been fun spending time with you this week. Regular host Steve Teotakis will be back on the mic on Monday. Thanks for listening.